Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 231.
Man, moving right along.
Yeah, we are.
When is 300 coming? We'll have a new theme song.
We'll renumber before that.
Oh, man.
A brand new number one.
Let's get chromium.
Yeah.
Let's become holograms.
Roguecast 12.1.
Oh, man.
Roguecast 0.1. We're not doing that.
Okay, thank God.
Yeah. Anyway.
But we should get polybagged anyway.
Yeah, we should definitely get polybagged. It's sort of a weird week for us.
How so, Randy?
Light on the news.
Yes.
Sort of a lightish comic week, because it's the last week of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a few topics, but only a handful. So this will be a lighter, maybe possibly a weirder podcast.
I believe there's actually one more week in this month. I think there is.
You're
the 30th.
Right. The 31st, in fact.
It's Halloween, Wednesday, that's
31st.
Right.
Yep.
Let's see what we can do to make it weird and sexy.
Next week will be a spooky podcast.
Yeah.
Yay, I like spooky.
But there is going to be like some spookiness in the topics if we get to it. But in this,
yes, that's true. We've all been watching some spooky. In fact, I think all the topics are
get ready to get scary.
Yes. All right. Store news. This weekend, reminder, is Halloween Comic Fest. That is this Saturday, October 27th. Come in, get some free comics.
Get out.
And then get out. Or
wait. Or shop about.
Stick around and buy some stuff.
Shop about. Then get out.
Then hit the bricks, pal.
Is that our new slogan? Shop about, then get out?
Yes.
As slogans go, probably not the
greatest. We've been doing this for nearly two decades. You'd think we'd be better than that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's catchy.
It's catchy. It's kind of rhymey.
It rhymes.
Yeah. So. All right, well, let's definitely workshop it.
Yeah, yeah. the following weekend, Saturday, November 3rd, we have a couple events going on. One is we have the Illuminati Secret Meeting.
Whoa.
Which is a demo of the Illuminati game with some...
So are you saying, like, Professor Xavier and Black Bolt and all, they're going to actually have a meeting here?
No, the real Illuminati, not Bendis' dumb Illuminati.
Okay. So Beyonce,
yes. Beyonce's probably a card. The Illuminati card game is...
Yeah, it should have Beyonce and Jay-Z revealing their lizard form.
There's a new Illuminati card game. Come in and play. Get some demo cards and stuff like that. Yep. It'll be fun.
It's only a legendary game, y'all.
Also that day, our staffer Kate is going to be running her first Final Fantasy card game.
Yep.
We've
had some interest from a fair amount of interest. And Kate's super enthusiastic. Yep. It's a cool game. It's Final Fantasy, which everybody knows is super cool and has chocobos.
I'm not sure everybody knew that.
I'm more interested.
They have chocobos, y'all.
I'm more interested in the Cactar cards. Are there Cactar cards?
I am 100% sure of it.
I bet there are Cactar cards.
Cactars are cooler than chocobos.
I'm sure that chocobos...
You go on thinking that, Nick. You go on thinking that.
Chocobos and Cactars could be like their... It's like their mana. Like, you need three Cactars to cast this card.
Yes.
Two Cry chocobos.
Havoc and let slip the chocobos of war.
Yes. And then on the second weekend of November, Saturday, November 10th, and Sunday, November 11th, we haven't nailed all this down yet, but that is the Ravnica weekend, which the... D&D Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica will be coming out, the first Magic the Gathering D&D crossover.
Right.
And so we're hoping to have a DM run an adventure that weekend, and then possibly also a Magic draft in which any participant will get a, like, foil land card.
I have a dumb question.
Yep.
That I think I know the answer to.
Yep.
In Magic the Gathering,
uh-huh.
Because I don't play this card game.
Yep.
Although I think Anna's going to teach me some basics on it. But
you want to know or not?
We had a head-to-head battle last week.
Yes, I heard.
It was fun.
I heard you came out fighting.
I did. I killed her.
Yeah. With her own deck. That's mean, Nick.
I think it's possible she let Nick win so he would still want to play the game.
That's
She's like, oh, darn,
possible.
You got me. I forgot to use the manas.
And then she...
what happened. She told me how to...
Then she tossed his hair and was like, good job, champ.
Get him.
By the way, Anna is the only one tall enough to actually reach Nick's hair to tossle it.
That's true. And that's what makes it cool. But getting back to my dumb question... In Magic, are you basically portraying rival wizards?
Sort of, yes.
I mean, I know it's an abstract thing, but you're casting spells and stuff.
You're each playing a planeswalker as yourselves and casting out monsters, creatures, spells.
In D&D, I assume they are essentially using only the setting, right? You aren't playing going to be having, like, planeswalker isn't going to be like some elite class or something.
I would not be shocked if they include the actual planeswalker.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, I know they've got a rich sort of background and world and creatures and stuff like that, so that's, you know, you could do just the setting, but I imagine, like, does it change up the magic system itself?
I don't know.
But I would imagine they'll do factions, because all of those represent certain kind of factions of creatures.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Why wouldn't they do a Golgari and I don't... That's the only one I know.
All right. But this is a good question, Nick.
And a Ravnica, and a...
and a guild pack.
And a, no, and a, Super, like, and a okay. Super Saiyan.
And a
land station.
Boros. I'm trying to remember the...
Somewhere out there, someone is wincing?
Yeah. Oh, someone out there is screaming at their podcast right now.
Scream.
We're not sorry. We're mostly amused. Anyway.
Like, let me teach you.
We're just a bunch of old men who don't play Magic.
I did play Magic.
I played Magic, but...
I don't know all the stuff.
Studiously avoided it, so I had one thing in the store I didn't have to buy.
And now?
Everything else I have to buy.
And now Anna's going to teach it to you.
And next
week, Dave will have 100 magic cards, and he'll come in dressed like a wizard.
Yes.
You're a wizard, Dave.
Hello. I understand I can only wear these clothes if I play Magic now.
Yes.
So, news.
News, right. Okay, yeah. Yes.
There's some sort of rumory stuff, but it's all centered around the CW stuff.
Let's gossip.
So... The Superman show. They are talking about doing a Superman show with the CW.
Yeah, that's pretty big because they studiously avoided doing Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman.
I hate to buzzkill, but they actually debunked that. That is not
Did happening. They? Okay.
No! But that's a dramatic on-air turnaround. Yes. Never mind, people. We're about to entice you with some cool what-if scenarios.
I still think it would be super cool to do. Just do your stupid Batman show and Superman show and have them have... movies and television shows. It's
but
not crazy.
Speaking of cool what-if scenarios, though, we also saw a picture from the Elseworlds set. Okay. A couple of them, actually.
Right, the Elseworlds being the crossover between all the Arrowverse shows, right?
Yep,
the
CW it's going to introduce Batwoman.
It's going to just be Supergirl, Arrow, and Flash.
No Legends.
Legends are not participating.
They're not running right now. That's why.
No, it did. It started back up this week.
Oh, well, then I don't know why.
I just don't think they want to be involved.
I mean, it's you can only cram so much, and they might want to, like...
I don't know,
their
last crossover that included them was freaking amazing.
Yeah, but I figure sometimes you want a somewhat lighter crossover and you don't want to write 80 characters.
So we don't know exactly what Elseworlds is going to entail, but here's what we do know. There's a monitor in it, because we've seen a picture of him drinking a soda.
Yep.
For the scene, but rather a behind-the-scenes thing of the actor.
No, you don't know that.
I imagine
he
will be...
pretty strongly on this one.
It's going to be like Darkseid sitting on a couch. He's just going to be there.
What if their pitch was, what if you drank a lot of sodas? What if he's like he's a product placement character?
It's a good, it's an interesting point
he's
there.
He's like Randy. Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, always eating something,
yes,
so
yeah.
he's
so busy
always be drinking.
Monitoring everything that he didn't have time to stop and drink. I mean, Dave, tell me...
Snickers ad?
Tell me that's not more interesting than anything else that's ever been done with monitors.
You think when he gets hangry, he becomes the anti-monitor?
Yes, that's what happens. Have a Snickers, you'll turn back into the monitor.
You'll see that ad in a comic book in about 6 weeks.
So I have a thought that is not a comedy routine, and it is this. Do we think there's any chance... So you were just talking about having two separate, acknowledging two, say, Batmans or Supermans or whatever, right?
Yeah, I would like that.
Is there any chance that the Flash of the movies might show up amidst the various Flashes we have seen?
No.
I don't think so.
Because I think that would be a clever thing for them to do.
Oh, it would be.
Because it would basically... It's their way of doing their explanation episode. They're like, yes, that's a Flash in another universe. There's this Flash in another universe. And it's kind of telling people, don't panic. You can have multiple Flashes. You can have multiple everybodies.
I think that would be amazing. But I honestly think the Warner Brothers universe is in such disarray at the moment.
It's a lot of contracts and things like that. Yeah. But I think that'd be a cool thing for them to sneak in. But the coolest thing of all is the John Wesley Shipp, a.k.a. the original Flash of the 90s, who plays Barry's dad on the show.
And also the Jay Garrick of the Earth 2.
Yep. We'll suit up in the old 90s costume once again.
He looks great.
Yeah, like it looks like the 90s costume. I don't know if they tweaked it a little bit to make it look a little better.
I think they must have.
But it's minorly.
But it looks good. Like, and it still looks... I mean, it's very visibly the 90s costume.
Oh, yeah.
And that I was thinking, that's like the coolest kind of fan service, you know. It is a call out to the past. They did it right. It looks good. I mean, hopefully, it could still suck in the episode. I don't know.
I don't think it will.
But I have a feeling they're going to pull that one off.
Does that mean we're going to get a Mark Hamill trickster?
Oh, that'd be great.
No, it was a Mark Hamill. He played
the original trickster and then the new trickster in this timeline.
Yeah, correct. That's right. Yep.
So yes, he could be playing opposite himself. They'd have to probably do a little bit of special effects-y stuff with the makeup, but.
And also the big thing in that image was that Barry and Oliver have switched roles. And
right, like there's a universe out there where, what, Ollie became the Flash and Barry became Arrow?
Maybe they just switched costumes. We don't really know.
Right.
But
there's an opportunity for those ones.
Barry looks good in the Green Arrow togs. Ollie does not look so great in the Flash togs.
Yeah.
It is one of those things like, you know, we've seen this in the comic book Elseworlds all the time where, you know, like, Superman crash lands in Gotham and is raised by the Waynes or, you know, some weird kind of thing like that. So I imagine they're going to be alternate universe versions of themselves. Well,
Grant Gustin has a runner's build, more or less.
Yeah.
Stephen Amell does not. He's got a bodybuilder kind of. Yeah.
He's got a
muscular.
Well, what do you call that thing he leaps around with his metal stick and does pull-ups on?
Salmon ladder.
Oh, what is it?
Salmon ladder.
Did you say salmon ladder?
Salmon ladder.
Is that what they call
it? That's what it's called.
Did you just make that up?
No, because you're swimming upstream.
Oh, okay. That's neat. I like it better now. I like salmon. I like ladders. Ladder? Come on.
I was just imagining a ladder entirely made of salmon. And
I was picturing
weird.
Leslie Nielsen in that ad for the spoof of The Fugitive that he did way back when, where he's swimming like a salmon in the water.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Remember.
That is the deepest cut we have featured on this podcast.
Listen, we're doing a sidebar about salmon, and I'm
What was the name? Wrongfully Accused.
Yes.
Here's the funny thing. Everyone in this room knows exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and if we can, we'll put a link in the notes, in the show notes.
We're not going to do that.
All right, but I just want people to know that I have looked that up on YouTube before. It took a little bit of work, but I found it.
So if you're listening and you're like, what the hell are they talking about? The answer is...
Look up the trailer for Wrongfully Accused. It's
wrongfully
in the trailer.
Wrongfully Accused trailer on YouTube.
Yeah.
You will all become clear.
You will see a man salmon.
Yes. All right. We got a lot of potential topics, a lot of potential titles this week. The other story, that was one news story. It's probably a good thing we have a lot of stories.
Oh, my goodness.
The other news story is that Netflix just announced they canceled Luke Cage. The week after they canceled Iron Fist, they said, yeah, no season 3 of Luke Cage.
As people on the internet, the internet wags
people
joked.
People freaked out.
They said now they really are heroes for hire.
Yeah.
I've also, of course, there was the Thanos gag.
Yep, he dissolved them.
Yep. There's two obvious things. One is Marvel's pulling the deal on Netflix.
That is actually... I have a friend who did some digging. Apparently, yeah. Marvel can't. They're under contracts.
Oh, okay.
So the only people who can cancel it is Netflix.
So Netflix is canceling
it. So Netflix is canceling it for some reason.
Is it possible they don't want to promote what is essentially going to be a competitor?
I mean, that's possible, but they just put out Daredevil Season 3. Punisher?
But they had already done Daredevil, and they may not be doing Punisher, right?
I mean,
Marvel kind of handled... They're promoting like the Fantastic Four and other stuff like that when it was still over at, was it Fox?
Yeah.
In the movies, they basically stopped the comics and stopped supporting what would make billions for the movie people or millions.
That's the thing. Is it possible? The other possibility is it that the ratings have not been great on these?
Yeah.
I thought they had been, but...
I think, like you've said before, we don't know Netflix's rating.
Yeah.
We don't know their
downloads
and stuff.
Sometimes stuff gets snuck out, but nobody has an official,
Yeah, so I would imagine some of these have not been the gangbusters, because I know Daredevil is amazing.
Or, if they still have the rights, they may have decided to do the thing we all think they should have done in the first place, which is just make a damn Power Man and Iron Fist show.
Yep. Just do a Heroes for Hire show, and then do a Daughters of the Dragon show.
Yeah.
Have y'all seen Daredevil current season?
I've not watched any of it.
No,
I've heard pretty decent stuff from people.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Kingpin comes back, Vincent D'Onofrio, and
Bullseye's in it.
So, I've heard really, really good things. I was too busy watching, the 1,700 shows that I've on my DVR.
there's a lot on right now.
Yeah.
That's true. All right. That's it for news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week.
One familiar cry. Rocast.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, October 24th, the week before Spooky Wednesday.
Yes.
I hope there's a lot of horror comics next week.
You know what?
We'll make our own.
And let's do some kind of feature. We don't want it to just be straight up Junji Ito, but let's think about this and come up with some kind of little horror comics tie-in or
something. Next week, all comics we discuss, we'll discuss how they could be spookier.
Yep. We could also talk about horror RPG experiences, including not just like recent stuff like Dread, but Randy, I'm sure you've played Call of Cthulhu and maybe some other ones in the past.
Sure, yeah.
So,
but importantly, next week will be spookier.
Like, it's going to be spooky, you'll shit yourself.
I was waiting for the end of that metaphor, and it just got bad.
I don't want to be here for that.
I meant the audience, y'all, not us.
I will promise 20 to 22% more spooky than our average.
I can beat that. I would say about 35.
Okay, 35 to 37% spookier. Nick, what's your first comic this week?
My first comic does involve magic. Not very spooky, but this is Books of Magic number 1. Sort of spinning out of the Sandman universe. This is a book that I think we've all read, yep. Especially the original one.
Which
Neil Gaiman and...
About 4 different artists, including...
Yeah, it was 4 different artists.
Charles Vess and John Bolton and a bunch of other stuff.
Basically about a young boy named Timothy Hunter, who is supposed to be the greatest magician ever lived.
Yep. He's an English kid who, by coincidence, and I think maybe preceding it slightly, looks a little bit like Harry Potter.
Does.
They have dropped his round glasses that he had, which... in the 90s made him look exactly like Harry Potter. Now he looks a little different.
I mean, that look is shown in some of the flashbacks.
Yeah, as it should be, because this takes into account the past history. It's just that you don't need to know it.
Well, I think you and I were discussing this a little bit before the pod, and we were hoping that they still included its ties to the DC universe,
right,
and not like forget everything that came before. And I was immediately happy to see that Constantine, Phantom Stranger,
Dr. Occult,
and...
Mr. E.
Still in there, because Mr. E is one of the creepiest freaking characters.
Right, at least as Neil Gaiman portrayed him. I don't know if he was that way.
If you say his name fast, it's Mystery.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that crazy theory later. So this was... Neil Gaiman did that miniseries in the early 90s, where...
1990, in fact.
Yeah, I remember reading it in high school.
And then it spun out to its own Vertigo series that ran, probably 50 issues?
I was just looking that up, and yeah, it was at least 50. I think it might have gone like 60.
DC had the original miniseries in print right now, by the way, in a graphic novel.
That would be nice.
Slipped out. But it's a favorite of mine, because basically these four eerie magic user types show up and say... Hey, young English kid, you have the potential to be the greatest magic user of your age, the next Merlin maybe, essentially, with all the danger and peril and tragedy that might ensue, but also all the greatness. And they take him on a tour of all the strangeness of the DC universe, the magic side of it, which is very much the, kind of a darker side of it, because this was kind of through Vertigo. To see if he wants to pursue it. Like, they're like, you can become a magic user or not. Now, Nick, I have not read all of this, but I did skim the opening, and I saw that they kind of flash back to that, and then they, only maybe like a year or two older than it was.
So from what I understand...
But I don't know where it goes.
I don't think this is referencing the actual series. This feels like it's just Neil Gaiman's miniseries.
Oh, they had just given him the choice, and then...
Yeah, that's it. And this starts up with him having chosen...
Okay.
And basically,
he just chose not magic, it's going to be a slow series.
It is going to be a slow series. But no, he chooses
Books
magic.
Books of not magic.
Books of not magic.
Books of mundanity.
Yeah, and this is sort of hopping back into his real world where he's dealing with, like, just his life with his dad and sort of at school.
Yep.
Where he has made this choice to choose magic, and he's sort of frustrated with it. It's not like everything doesn't happen all at once. He doesn't get to do spells. He wants to do spells.
Right.
And it's sort of...
It's not quite what he thinks it is.
Right. Like. And so he's still having to deal with school life and school bullies and like a romantic interest that he's kind of pining for. Mm-hmm. And there is a teacher that I guess is somehow tied into the occult at his school that is looking out for him. So there was kind of all these little things, and I loved that. I mean, I didn't read much of the actual series itself.
This is the John Nay Reber.
And it was very heavy on the fairy stuff.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
You finish your thought, and I'll...
So I was actually pretty happy that it... Because I remember the miniseries perfectly. Mm-hmm. That one has just kind of made its mark in my brain.
That was the key question I wanted to ask. How approachable is this?
It is approachable.
Okay.
I still think that should be in print and people should read it.
Yeah.
But I feel
like I'm sure it'll be back in print soon.
But it is extremely approachable because it gives kind of a Cliff Notes version of that story.
Okay.
Through some very talented artwork by Tom Fowler. He gets
it's nice looking.
A couple of different styles that he's able to mimic.
So he draws the whole issue.
He does.
Right.
And
a quick question, and edit this out if it spoils something. The person who is it a teacher he's talking to that has some knowledge of magic?
Yes.
She looks like the female incarnation of Dr. Occult in the original Books of Magic series.
Rose. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Is her name Rose?
Rosé, possibly.
Maybe.
Do they actually say...
It's a similar kind of haircut.
It could be. It wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, I don't know.
And that was like... That was something that Neil Gaiman introduced that I don't think had been part of the character before. That
right.
This guy who was like this trench coat wearing, looked kind of like an old 30s detective, had this like aspect that he... Like, I think when they did go to the fairy realm... he incarnated as.
Okay, right. So it's interesting. I'm not seeing her name actually mentioned.
Well,
so that
is also,
kind of...
If they did take into account the Neil Gaiman miniseries, you would think if that was her, he would say, oh, hey, I know you. You took me on a tour of the Magic Fairy Verse about a month ago.
Right. I mean, that is completely possible.
So this may just be a little visual similarity, but I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. But I actually think it's a great first issue. It's the first of the Sandman Universe books that I've been outright, like, super
been
enthusiastic
into.
For.
What I remember in the original miniseries is there was this kind of like cult that was trying to assassinate him. Is there any sort of threat, or is it all kind of internal?
You bring up a possibility because that is kind of touched on as well.
Okay.
So there are new things here. I think people will dig it.
Cool. Awesome.
All right. So my pick this week is, well, I have two picks, but my pick that is a number one is actually Spider-Girl's number one. There are three Spider-Geddon tie-ins this week. One is Spider-Geddon number two, one is Spider-Girl's, and one is Nick's other pick. Spoilers. And this one is about this very Spider-Girl. So the daughter of Mary Jane and Peter Parker in the, what's it called, Spider-Man family? What's it called?
Friendly Neighborhood Spider.
No, it's not that. I've blanked on it now. But it's the Spider-Man book that Jody Houser's been writing. It's about the family.
Renew Your Vows.
Renew Your Vows. The alternate universe where they have a kid whose name is Annie, who has powers, and they fight crime as a crime-fighting family.
Which, actually, I think they do a great job.
I had not been reading it, but Jody Houser introduces all the characters well here. It turns out Mary Jane is wearing, like, a spider costume that gives her powers.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
It turns out that Annie has... A heightened spider sense, which has sort of been hinting at her about the Spider-Geddon stuff coming up.
Yeah.
She's tied into the Web of Life.
Oh, like it's like got some prophetic
Yeah, it's
stuff.
It's a bigger thing.
It's not on like kind of Madame Webbish.
That's actually pretty cool.
And then so coming as a result of Spider-Geddon number two, a lot of the characters split off looking for different allies. And Anya Corazon, a.k.a. Aranya, a.k.a. another Spider-Girl, and Mayday Parker, who is a... also a daughter of Peter and Mary Jane from an alternate history, although in her father and mother were killed during the original Spider-Verse.
Right.
So they come to this reality in search of a spider, and it turns out that they're looking for an alternate daughter. There's some interesting interplay there in that, there's a thing that ties into May in this universe. There's a thing that ties into Mayday seeing her parents alive again, and... they're basically like recruiting these characters, and it seems like these three Spider Girls are going to join up with the fight. It's really good. It's a world I had not read anything of, but it kind of made me want to read more of it. I definitely recommend it. And so far, Spider-Geddon is working for me.
I also really just liked seeing Peter as a father.
Yeah, me too.
It was an interesting take on him.
Yeah. Dave, what is your pick?
my pick is I feel like it's forced by law at this point. I pick all the Star Trek Next Generation comics that the Tiptons are putting out since the Mirror Universe.
Yep.
This is Star Trek Next Generation Terra Incognita, issue 4.
Yep.
And this continues their trend of essentially standalone, like it'd be episodic style Next Generation stories with a little bit of stealth Mirror Universe Barkley sneaking about and doing his stuff.
Sure.
And it was just, this would be one of those ones where I was like, that was a good episode. That was a good, solid episode. It had some good questions to ponder in it. It starts on it with an interesting thing that very much like seems like an updated Kobayashi Maru, don't you feel?
Yeah, definitely. Randy? Yeah. I had forgotten, Wesley's kind of the focus, and I'd forgotten where he was in the status quo at this point.
Right. I think this is around season four or
he's still an ensign.
But I think he's, what is it? Was he on a command track? I can't remember what
it
he was
seems
doing.
Like, because he's the captain in the simulation, which I thought was kind of neat.
And it's, in the original Kobayashi Maru, you're supposed to try and rescue a ship in a dangerous neutral zone territory with Klingons and stuff moving in. Here, they have it updated where it's Cardassians. And he's kind of showing a little bit of timidity. He's playing it sort of a little safe, knowing it's a simulation to see what will happen.
Well, if you need someone to coach you out of timidity, I know who you call.
The Chair Stradler himself.
Chair Stradler himself.
William Riker.
Yep.
and sure enough, this is kind of a Riker and Wes issue. And
you know the Star Trek stuff better than me. Did they do much with that? That was such a natural pairing. I really liked it.
I think it only occasionally turned up. Every once in a while, he'd be like, Mr. Riker, he's like, I don't know how to talk to girls. And he's like, well, Wes, you got to treat a lady like a lady. And I remember some episodes like that, but it was not something they ran with very much. It is something that the comics, I feel like, could take more advantage of.
Yeah.
Because it's not like he can go hang around with Picard. That's a very special episode when that happens.
Young Wesley, let me tell you what it used to be like.
They have to be trapped on a space shuttle or something like that for them to be hanging out together. So the premise in this one is that they are kind of assessing a race for entry into the Federation. And they have the same sort of weight hanging over it that they did an issue or two back, which is they need people in the Federation because the fleet's still wrecked from the Borg fight.
Yeah.
Was it Wolf 359?
Yeah, I like that it's like an industrial war where they're basically, these are builders. Mm-hmm. It was kind of nuts.
They had they had this giant bay where you see like a dozen starships being constructed automatically, like in a giant processing plant.
It's weird. It's almost non-Starfleety though, because Starfleet is such a socialist collective,
right?
And this is very much not that kind of world. But they need their resources,
right? I think there has always been an acknowledgement that they have to negotiate stuff with people for resources are still a thing in the future, if Starfleet doesn't use money,
right?
What they discover on this planet, and it's Riker, Wes is kind of coming down to get some practical experience. Barclay is there. We know his evil mirror, Barclay. And, I'm going to call it an NPC, a lesser-known character who I'm sure was in an episode, but I don't remember.
Oh, do you think she was?
I think so. They named her, or they made a point to have Wes kind of be concerned about her, so
but
I think
she's
she was
a red shirt.
She's effectively for this.
But red shirt is a good thing in the Next Generation.
That's true. Riker's a red shirt. What ends up coming out of this is that this is a kind of, this society has a sort of caste. And it's broken up into, like, an administration that does kind of all the social interaction and sort of planning and thinking. There's the builder class that's just sort of all the labor and construction.
And there was something else.
Let's see.
They're like the administrators that talk to them, the builders, and then another one I think...
Oh, like the healers and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They repair and heal and stuff like that. And essentially, there's a problem that almost immediately upon arrival... and they are having a tough time doing the usual Star Trek investigation because the administrators are like, yeah, you can't talk to them.
Yeah.
And this kind of fills in for probably, I would imagine, like, you can see allegories of, like, labor disputes.
Yeah.
But this is their whole society, though. It's not just, even though it's kind of has to do with a vast industrial complex, it also is sort of about, you'd imagine it is any sort of caste system, any sort of heavy division of... you know how, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson a few years ago said that all the big politicians and all the congressmen were all basically, like, lawyers and...
Yeah, I remember that.
Full-time politicians.
Yeah.
And he's like, where's the rest of the breadth of life and stuff like that? You know, the doctors and any other jobs at all.
Right.
This has that same sort of sense of, like, because they're so stringent about it, that there's these problems they're overlooking and there's a big mystery to be had... And of course it focuses on Wes since he's the guy, our character from the beginning, and he has to kind of play outside the rules a little bit in this one. He has to do his own Kirk, I'm going to say. Anyway, it was just another good rock solid issue. I thought, as I always want when with a good Star Trek story, has some topics that you can turn over in your head afterwards.
These are good. These are really good, like single episode stories.
Yeah.
Also, what's interesting to me is that you and I know we're both fans of the Mirror Universe stuff, especially the first one and the second one to some extent. And I think that that brought up a lot of people in who otherwise wouldn't have read a Star Trek Next Gen comic.
Yep.
And they've sort of stealthed in a actual just Next Gen comic.
Yep.
Is that what they're going to do? Like, is they're going to do a series of miniseries?
Well, Barclay's there, and he's from the Mirror Universe, but it doesn't even come up here. Like, it's right. There's a little wink and nod.
He is not acting. He's acting a little bit more aggressive than Barclay would, or that is to say, more effective in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Which is pretty harsh. But
evil Barclay's good at things. Yeah. Good Barclay's not.
Yeah. I guess he's been just tied up in his room for the last few weeks.
I mean, that's not much different than how it was for the most time when Barclay was in.
That's just mean.
It probably doesn't change his effectiveness at all.
Do you think mean Barclay goes over and gives him, like, a noogie every once in a while?
Yeah, I think he does.
Like, because that's the kind of thing you think he might do. Mere evil would be Barclay.
Yeah,
is.
Just give him a noogie.
Yep. Yeah.
Not shoving
they
into
do.
That pain.
He might. He's actually pretty scary when he needs to be. What I'm wondering, there is some stuff coming up there. There are some more, I'm blanking. So they have a big crossover between all of the, that has Q and is going to involve all of the, different universes.
Yeah, you're way more up on the Star Trek comics than I am.
And then they've got the Peter David one shot that's going to be painted by the guy who did the first Mirror Universe one,
right.
J.K. Woodward, that's about young Picard, and Crusher. And I feel like the Tiptons may have yet another project, but I'm forgetting what it is. But yes, they are clearly, effectively, even if it's in a series of miniseries, they've got a Next Generation comic going.
Yeah,
that's
pretty
cool.
Your backup?
My backup pick is the second issue of Return of Wolverine. I like the first one. It's still written by Charles Soule, who wrote The Death of Wolverine. Mm-hmm. He wrote The Return of Wolverine, and he wrote one of the miniseries that was Hunt for Wolverine.
Yep.
So he's kind of been pegged as the guy who has a real strong handle on the character. I've liked almost everything he's done before because he's calling out what I think the richest history of Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, the mystery continues where Wolverine kind of like woke up and... one of those evil research facilities like he's always waking up in.
It seems like a thing that happens.
Heavy memory loss, a lot of dead people around him, and a lady scientist to protect who seems like she had kind of been working for the bad guys under duress.
Yeah.
There's an interesting facet to this that was brought up in the first one where... I forget exactly how it manifested in the first one, but he clearly had a lot of, I don't know if it was virtual world stuff, or like just inside his head, but there was like this massive like sort of prison, and all the people and all the cells were aspects of his personality.
Yep. Yeah, I actually that's the thing I like about this, where we keep seeing like elements of his personality locked away, and sometimes one of them will make an appearance, and you see that it's him regaining a memory and a skill, and that's an interesting idea.
And there is a question of how much of what we see in this, which is essentially a sea-based chase with boats and fighting and other stuff going on, whether some or all of it may be a sort of some kind of weird Matrix type thing.
Yeah.
Because there's appearances by what seems to be Omega Red and his son, who is last we knew is deceased.
Yeah, that's true. But they brought Wolverine back. They clearly have the technology.
Right. I would actually kind of like to see what else they might do with Dekan. I almost like kind of just straight up want him back. I just think he's an interesting...
Really?
Yep. Even though he was kind of a weird character and they didn't quite know whether they wanted him to be a hero or a villain, I feel like he should... He is an interesting foil for Wolverine.
Hmm. I feel differently.
Yeah, fair enough.
I liked again. I think he was utilized well in like Tom Taylor's All New Wolverine, and
I think stuff could be done with him.
Yeah,
And I think Wolverine honestly needs a bit of a shot in the arm. I don't think they were ever on like speaking terms much, and I wonder what would happen if like Wolverine and his
during Rick Remender's Uncanny X-Force, he actually killed Deccan. He drowned him.
That was the end of him, right?
No. Whoa. He brought back and he was in the. He was in All New Wolverine, Tom Taylor's thing.
Yep, that's right.
And then he showed back up in one of the Hunt for Wolverines, and that's where he was most recently killed.
Okay. Yep,
during the zombie stuff.
You gotta remember, I think Tom Taylor gets a certain dispensation to write. He wrote Deadpool that I liked. Yeah, I feel like that's not a reflection of the character. That's a reflection on Tom Taylor.
Well, that's a reflection on what these characters.
Once it's happened, though, then other writers can do the same.
But it's also a reflection that, like, a good writer can make any of these characters good.
Yeah,
that's true. Any character can be good, even the Ken.
That's true.
But not Deadpool.
Sure, just throw that out in the room. I'm sure it's clear that the sales prove you right.
Yes, nobody likes Deadpool.
I was very happy with the fight in the boat, though, because there's a
cool fight in there, and it's a typical, well, not typical, but it's a brutal Wolverine-style fight.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say how, but he does use the claws thing that he's got where he can, like, they will clearly heat up. He doesn't know what their deal is.
I'm still weirded out by that.
But he does it in a kind of cool way. Yeah. I'm trusting at this point in Charles Soule to come up with something interesting.
I'm sure he has a reason why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
I am fascinated to find out, like, why he decided that was a power to add to Wolverine, because it seems so strange.
It is weird, but it was used cool.
It was used well. Yeah, I mean, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Beyond that, it's the Wolverine I like. He's a tough guy and a hard ass, but he's, like, got this compassionate side to him, too.
He has a heart of gold.
He has a heart of gold.
Well, in the first issue, didn't they unlock... The thing that he unlocked was the superhero version of Wolverine, right?
Yeah, if you want to think about it that way, then...
This is sort of the best qualities of Wolverine. This is not kind of, like...
Right.
The if hard ass murderer. If that is the case,
then he's maybe having to come to terms with a... kind of a dark past, maybe a little bit, or like a threat at least with Omega Red, and some of his like darker past with DeKen.
Yeah.
We'll see where they take it. By the end of the issue, there's also a reveal about where we jump back in. We see Jean Grey and Kitty Pryde, and that's clearly has to be the real world, even if the other is not.
Yeah.
That kind of develops their hunt for him, and it looks essentially like they have pinned down where he is, and there'll be something of that intersecting with the story.
Well, and that's the thing that I think argues for it being a simulation, but given that they're telepaths, they may have found his brainwaves in a way.
Right.
But it doesn't make it a clear, like, they could have found his brainwaves because he's out in the world on a speedboat. Sorry, go-fast boat.
We like to talk about the go-fast boats.
We do like to talk about the go-fast boats.
As we learned all about in the Miami Vice movie, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my second pick, or follow-up pick. What else you got, Randy?
My backup pick is, speaking of Tom Taylor, like I always do, and Jean Grey, X-Men Red, number 9. This is continues the war of basically Jean Grey's faction of X-Men versus Cassandra Nova, who I liked because Morrison made her, but they have definitely, she is a scary, scary villain.
Well, she was like an A-list threat in Morrison's run.
Yeah. I mean, she's like Omega-level mutant, she's got Xavier's telepathic powers, and she's psychotic.
Do they tell how she's back?
I was going to say, she was also a dead person.
She was also pretty dead.
I don't know, she's back, I don't remember.
Villains have a way of returning.
I mean, that's true.
More than anybody else.
Anyway, in this one, she had taken control of Rachel Grey, and Jean Grey goes to fight her. And winds up basically having to fight Rachel.
So that is Jean Grey fighting her daughter,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Alternate
version
daughter.
And then she has to make a deal with Cassandra to free her daughter. And there's some great little bits where you see good guys don't always have to be dumb. Sometimes they can have cool plans. And Jean Grey does.
Nice.
I really like this book. I really think it's doing something different than all the other X-Men books, and I'm glad it's continuing, even though Gold and Blue have wrapped up.
I have a silly question for you.
Yes?
You say you like this book, but do you like facial hair Nightcrawler?
It's all right.
Yeah. He dons the cover, so I had to ask. I like facial hair Colossus.
It's a little disconcerting.
Like, this is really Jean Grey's book. Like, the other characters are good. There's a cute moment in here with some of the other mutants, and there's a good moment with Jean and Storm, but really, this is Jean Grey's book.
Yeah.
Nick, what is your backup?
My backup pick, as Randy teased, does tie into Spider-Geddon. That is Spider-Gwen Ghost Spider number 1.
Yep.
Written by Shauna McGuire, who most recently wrote the X-Men Gold Annual. And I feel like they wrote one other thing recently, didn't they?
Shauna McGuire wrote...
The X-Men Gold, and then there was something
They wrote the X-Men Black Mystique.
Ah, right, the X-Men Black Mystique. And artist Rosie Kump?
I don't know the name.
I don't know either. But it feels very much in line with sort of the Robbie Rodriguez style that has, you know, been used for Spider-Gwen the entire run. But honestly, I think I haven't read much of that book, so I was kind of coming into this cold. And it catches you up with the majority of her world.
Does it tell you about how she was taken on a magical tour by John Constantine and the Phantom Stranger?
Not so much.
Oh, that's a different book.
That's a different book. this is sort of kind of catching up because apparently she was in prison. She was accused and convicted of something.
Yeah, a lot happened in Spider-Gwen that Nick and I have not been reading.
Well, it was running for like a couple years.
Yeah, yeah. Like issue 50, I think.
Obviously something
more
happened with Matt Murdock and his version of the hand that I guess they came to some sort of head.
Right.
She was in prison.
Do we get the sense, is she like college age right at this point?
I would imagine.
Or still older high school maybe.
Maybe.
She still seems youngish.
Freshman in college.
Don't you go to like juvenile detention rather than prison?
Yeah, and that's sort of what they said. They say like prison, so they don't say like juvenile detention or anything. But this is an alternate Earth, so who knows?
They don't have juvie on alternate Earth.
It's possible.
They put all their
Everything else was the same as us, but no juvie.
Same, but 5-year-olds go to hardcore prison. 5-year-olds go to max.
So she also, I guess. Spoilers, small, mild spoilers in the fact that her suit is a Venom suit.
Yeah, which is weird.
Which is bizarre.
But she seems to have control of it.
Do you just mean that it's a symbiote?
She's got a symbiote. Yeah.
But she has it completely under control.
Well,
it
I mean, among
like,
other things, it has the normal colors of hers and not scary Venom colors.
Well, and also, it doesn't affect her. It doesn't have a voice. It doesn't, it's kind of, she's in complete control of it, which
You know what this is a weird analog to? The same way She-Hulk was in control of the Hulk's powers when she got them.
Which I thought was interesting. But this is sort of her kind of coming back to her superhero life and then being approached by Spider-Ham.
I have to say, Spider-Ham's a little too silly for me.
I like almost every Spider-Verse.
I like their use of Spider-Ham. I mean, I get what you're saying.
It's a little like Howard the Duck, and you know, like, so it's not like it's like a deal killer or anything. He's not my favorite, though.
No, I get that.
We'll have to discuss this in detail sometime so we can determine what weird funny animal is our favorite. Like, I can somehow work more with like Rocket Raccoon or Chip, where there's an alien that happens to look like one of ours, but they're not a literal cartoon character come to life.
Yeah.
That's my dividing line.
Well, you know, Spider-Ham also has the unfortunate, he comes from a world much like the much hated Zoo Crew.
Yes.
Where everyone is
right,
a
and not my favorite
farm.
Style. Yeah. I wonder if on Spider-Ham's world you go to prison at age 5.
Yeah, in Spider-Ham's world you just go to the farms.
Yeah,
oh, no. Anyway, suffice to say, Spider-Ham shows up. That's not deal killer.
And she gets drawn into the whole Spider-Geddon stuff.
Right.
And that sort of spins out of the Spider-Geddon number 2. A big thing happens in that one.
And she's on a new Earth.
And she's on a new Earth, dealing with a new sort of Hobgoblin, Green Goblin kind of analog.
Yeah, we're not sure what.
We're not sure, but there's new stuff involved. I actually just thought it was a really good issue. A lot of fun, great action, and it caught the reader up on everything you really needed to know about the character.
Sean McGuire does really good moment-to-moment writing, too.
It was completely good, and I thought the art was fantastic.
So that brings up a point, though, about Spider-Geddon. I just want to mention real quick, because Spider-Geddon 2 comes out this week. I think you and I both really enjoyed it.
Very much so.
We were noticing, it's kind of interesting that basically, this story like has the inheritors going up against the spider crew, and during the course of it, something happens where like, this is where Edge of Spider-Geddon number 0 happens, and this is where Superior Octopus happens, and this is where Spider-Gwen takes place, and here's where Spider-Geddon number 0. So like they drop some different stuff in the time
they
period.
They give a specific timeline of what happens when.
Wait, do they do that during the course of the issue, or is there a time? There's a thing after?
There's editorial notes in there.
Oh,
so
okay.
Like here is where Spider-Geddon 0 goes in this story.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty cool. I liked it.
It was really interesting. Some other stuff I've got on my stack, I just have a few. Two of them are Infinity Warps related.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the Arachnite number 1, which is a combo of Spider-Man and Moon Knight.
That's weird.
I love the costume.
The costume
is fantastic.
Great.
Do you remember their parody of Dark Knight way back in the 90s, Randy, that had like Todd McFarlane, I think, era, where it was like the Arachnite Returns?
Yes, I do remember that.
It was
that.
Just cover copy, nothing to do with this, but they did. They've dropped that name before.
Yep.
Yeah, but anyway. This gives sort of a new origin story for Spider-Man, how he basically, they take the totem idea of Spider-Man and Moon Knight and kind of blend it into like one totem.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense.
And the young Peter Parker gets sort of he's not insane, but he has another like Egyptian kind of spider living in his brain.
Should be a scarab.
It should have been a scarab. That would have been cool.
But it's got to be a spider because that's the thing.
And just kind of reinventing the world of Peter Parker and, you know, his and Harry Osborn, and it was interesting. more interesting was the Soldier Supreme number 2, as it's got fantastic art and it's just fun of the Doctor Strange Captain America combo breaking out of hell.
You got to talk about the villain.
There is a villain of MODOK and Baron Mordo.
Right.
And he is a mental... What is the breakdown of the...
Mental organism designed only for killing?
No.
Is the normal thing.
Yes, yes, but this is now a mental organism ritually designed for the occult.
So MODOK.
Okay. All right.
That's pretty good.
And just the actual visual is pretty great.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Looks like Tom Mandrake drew it. It also looks weirdly like he has Lockjaw's mustache.
He has Mordo's mustache.
He has Mordo's mustache.
By the mustache of Mordo.
Does the Lockjaw have Mordo's mustache?
What if there's... Is you're saying there's only one mustache and Mordo has it?
But I was... You know, I was flipping through
it's
here and I was like...
shared with the other...
I was flipping through this and I'm like, oh man, this art is really, really good. Who is this? And it makes sense. It's Adam Kubert. It is really good.
By the multiversal mustache of Mordo.
Also a possible title for the episode. Yep.
And then the last one I have is Black Panther versus Deadpool. Not a combination that I ever thought I would see in a book, but...
Let's be honest. Deadpool combined with anybody is something that is probably going to show at some point.
Yeah, at some point.
There's going to be a Deadpool Spider-Ham next week.
That's probably true. Actually, people would buy that.
But this has T'Challa and Shuri and a reason for Deadpool being in Wakanda, and then lots of wild and crazy antics.
When I was making up the sign for it, they made out that there was actually like a serious sort of reason why Deadpool is like chasing after Vibranium or something in Wakanda. But you don't just go around like the sovereign nation of Wakanda stealing stuff without talking to Black Panther
first. It doesn't go well.
Or he'll drop a beatdown on you.
That's he true. Does. And he'll use the science against you.
Nice.
All right. Dave, your other backup picks this week?
I have to mention Scooby-Doo Team-Up number 43, sure. The comic for the youth, but it has their Doom Patrol in it, and I just had to see what they were doing with the Doom Patrol. I was excited to see that it's like the classic sort of Silver Age Doom Patrol, or so I thought just that. Aside from being entertainingly written, when they run into the Brotherhood of Evil, Velma notes that they're like, oh my... She's like, oh my gosh, that's Monsieur Mala. Didn't we capture him just last month? And indeed, he was apparently, I think, must have been in the previous issue. So so that they're like, oh yeah, we know all about you. But that is just the start of the weirdness, because it also has Grant Morrison Doom Patrol stuff sneaking around.
I think joked around that there's no way that this Scooby-Doo book will have more.
Crazy Jane shows up. Scooby-Doo thinks it's another villain, or as he says, another villain. and then she has to explain now she's one of the Doom Patrol members. Also, there's classic villains like the Animal Vegetable Mineral Man. That is as Silver Age as you can conceivably get. And Grant Morrison's Flex Mentallo is yes in here. Now, I'm going to have to read this at some point just to see how... obviously, it's very family-friendly... But somehow they had to explain away some of this weird stuff.
Yep.
And I just want to know how they did it. I'm going to randomly mention Superman Action Comics number 1004. I'm not following Bendis' thing, really. But there's a scene where for like 4 or 5 pages, Lois and Clark are in bed together and having a conversation. And I feel like that's Bendis at his best, just having characters talk.
Also, the cover looks like it's Superman is about to kill a bunch of geese.
Yeah, and as you know, I fear the geese. So
yeah, they're really mean creatures.
If Superman would destroy them, I have to defend the geese now. They're aggressive creatures. They're like Dungeons & Dragons.
He says aggressive, I say mean.
They're neutral. The animals are all neutral. But they might be neutral evil.
Yeah, geese might be neutral evil. Nobody needs a geese's advocate, Dave.
There's a Old Lady Harley, number 1. That's just their miniseries with Harley 30 years in the future doing her crazy Harley stuff.
Yep.
I haven't read it yet, but I did see that in this future that Power Girl is president.
Sure.
That Atlantis has been is now a state in America.
Okay.
And I think she's like, oh, Mr. J might still be alive and she may have to kill him again or something.
Okay, sure.
Star Wars Tales from Vader's Castle. This latest issue has scary Ewok stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's maybe worth
a look. Well, they are cannibals.
Well, not cannibals.
Right.
They're just carnivores.
Carnivores, you're
and
right.
They will eat anything, any other...
They're going to eat Luke and Han.
Tonight, they dine on man flesh.
Yeah, but they won't eat Ewoks, which make them cannibals. You're right.
Right.
They're not
They're not disgusting like
no,
that.
No, no.
I did always think it'd be funny if at the end, when there's all those severed stormtrooper heads and they're like cooking them and stuff like that, if before Luke burned Vader's body, they kind of got at it. They had to shoo them off because they were nibbling at it.
get away!
sorry. Nick made it the strangest Ewok sound, and I...
Well, that was pretty accurate.
It was pretty close.
By the way, Carnivorous Ewoks would be a fantastic band name.
I think so.
That would be great.
Also, on the weird front, this kind of is a decent segue, there's a Mars Attacks comic that's weird, like every Mars Attacks comic ever has been.
Mm-hmm.
But it's notable because Chris Schweitzer, the super talented cartoonist, draws it, and it's about a kind of a... what do you call him? A slacker dude in his 30s, 40s.
Is his dad or his granddad? It's his dad, right?
His dad was like, because he's a little bit older and is still kind of like aimless in life. And his dad is like in retirement and he's a cranky old man. And they're having their father-son discussions when suddenly a doctor comes in and is like, I don't know if y'all have been watching the news, but we've been invaded and every city has fallen. And so we're euthanizing some people because, he's literally got like an injection ready. He's like, if you guys want to be euthanized, we can do it. And the old guy's like, hell no. He's like, let's go kick some ass. But then he's like, moves at like a snail's pace with his walker, and it's kind of darkly funny.
It is darkly funny.
Before the issue is out, an old, cranky old lady in a wheelchair will go by on fire.
Just like in the movie Manhunter.
Just like in the movie Manhunter. That's a nice call. A.K.A. Red Dragon, A.K.A.
A.K.A. I don't know what else.
It was like on a season of Hannibal, too,
right? Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So I have to ask, do the aliens, if we see
them... You don't see them up close enough to hear the ack-ack.
Aww.
I don't think.
But whenever I see the picture, I imagine the ack-ack.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, just assume it's happening. But it is more of a... this is played more as a disaster thing approaching.
Yeah.
And now it's like there's more issues to come, so I assume they got to get up close and personal and they will cack them.
Or they'll play that song that explodes their head.
That's the only... In the Tim Burton verse canon.
Yeah, that's the only thing. I don't think that's usually a thing.
Yeah.
I liked that, though. That was funny.
And it was weird.
that whole movie was weird.
Lastly, I wanted to just mention a big old coffee table type hardcover Super Mario Brothers encyclopedia that came out this week.
It's
It looks super cool, as it should. They describe it as over 250 pages jam-packed with content from 17 Super Mario games. So aside from, like, talking you through all the different games, there's also the producer talking about the early days of Nintendo and the development of the first Mario game. And they talk about, like, glitches and weird stuff in the game. It looks, like, profusely and beautifully illustrated with, you know, design artwork, screenshots, and stuff like that. If you are a Mario fan, and I feel like everybody should be, then you probably want to pick up this guidebook.
All right. Just a couple from me. Rolled and Told number 2. This is the blend of comics and gaming magazine. There are two adventures, one of which is a village overrun by undead. The other one is a traveling carnival. There's a story about trolls and how you can make them nastier.
This is like a Halloween issue, right?
Yep. There is a tavern story where here's a bunch of people you can drop in to give your players some hints.
Nice.
Which includes, by the way, a suggested menu with different D&D prices.
That's actually very handy. And as I know, players are notoriously fond of overlooking the obvious and forgetting to ask questions that should be super obvious.
Yep.
So having a few, having some pre-planned notions for how NPCs might impart the information seems like a good thing.
That is exactly what the article starts by saying. Is like, players are notorious for
being dumbass.
Players doesn't include requests, and players will brush right past them to air chase a stray thread you never knew was there.
Yep.
And there's a bunch of different ways to refocus them. And then there's a real good article on how to deal with the death of player characters.
Oh, interesting.
In which this DM notes that in starting a new campaign, I make a point of trying to kill a player character early on. I'm rarely malicious about it, which means sometimes he is. And I might even let one of my more experienced players in on the twist. It's an interesting style, and it's interesting. There's a bunch of great comic art throughout this.
I will read it for that article alone, and the other stuff all sounds cool, but that one particularly interests me just to see how to deal with how he suggests dealing with it.
This is great. I continue to really enjoy it, and gamers should definitely pick that one up.
I've noticed it gaining nice traction at the store. It's got some subscribers to it now.
Yeah.
As it continues to become the Dragon Magazine of our day.
As it continues to roll on?
Yes, and told on. Wait, no.
I told on it. And then Punisher number 3, which is a Daredevil Punisher team up of sorts, in that Punisher and Daredevil hate teaming up. And Rat Queens number 12, which is a the second part of a new Rat Queen story, and I really enjoy it, and has a naked halfling goddess of sex and love.
That sounds completely in keeping with Rat Queen's philosophy.
I also want to mention the Banana Sunday. This is a story by Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover. Colleen Coover is probably best known for her
naughty comic,
dirty lesbian porn comic, Small Favors.
Yeah, this which is super good, by the way.
Which is super good and super cute. This is her all-ages book that has a girl going to school with three monkeys.
Yes.
And it's goofy, it's fun, and this is the first... It's been out of print for a long time. It's back in print, a little bit tweaked to be fully all-ages and full color, and I definitely recommend it.
Her art is super awesome in
her. Her art is super awesome. Also, it smells like it smells nice.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Because of paper smell.
You know I like to smell the books.
I do. All right, that's it for us for comics. We'll be back in just a second to talk about a movie and a podcast and, oh, who knows, a bunch of other stuff.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, we just have a few things to talk about, mostly in spooky modes. But I'm going to talk about the non-spooky thing first.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're spooked out by a lot of gore, in which case you'll still be spooked out. There is a new movie on Netflix. It is a foreign movie. I don't remember if it's from Thailand or Hong Kong. It might
so
be
not
Hong
a Netflix action. Original movie?
No, no. It was actually... It was at the... Fantastic Fest had it. And it was... It's a Hong Kong action movie. It's set in Hong Kong. It is called The Night Comes for Us. And it is a... it is a story of Ito, a gangland enforcer for the Triads, who basically it opens with this Triad squad like wiping out a village.
Uh-huh.
And Ito turns on his squad and rescues this little girl who's the only survivor, and then the entire Triad comes at him. So he has to go back to his old crew and fight off the Triads while there's also other people coming at him from various directions, a bunch of different factions.
Let me quick ask.
Yep.
Fight with fists or fight with guns?
Yes.
Okay.
Also axes.
All
right. Also
what's
knives.
What takes primacy?
A lot of hand-to-hand combat.
Okay.
Because
I was going to say, this sounds sort of like the premise that I used to watch in like John Woo's 90s Hong Kong, 80s and 90s Hong Kong output, where there's excuses for people to be killed by the legions.
Yeah.
He favored guns.
Yeah.
These guys favor fists a little bit.
Yeah, there's
so.
there are some guns in it, but it's definitely choppy knife movie of any kind.
Yep.
It's Indonesian is the place it was made.
Okay.
This is one of the best action movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
It's fantastic. Like, the story is, as you know, Dave, kind of tropey.
Right.
But
I don't necessarily hold that against them. The same way I look at an old, Motown song or something like that, and they can have some kind of trite lyrics, but the voices and the arrangement is what sells it. It sounds like the fisticuffs and the style is kind of what sells this.
Yeah, well, the characters are all really good.
Nice.
Like, I like all the work they do on the characters. There are a pair of lesbian gangland enforcers who are fantastic.
Nice.
There's kind of this badass woman who shows up, and she's kind of a third force. She's got her own agenda, and she's up against them, and then with them, and then against them, and there's some great sort of fight sequences. There's one that takes place in a bathroom. There was one that takes place in a... like a bar, their pool hall. They make great use of the settings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's got a little bit of that Jackie Chan found weaponry kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely feels like someone who grew up on all the different Hong Kong action movies and incorporated all the different style. There's some humor in it, but a lot of that comes from the character stuff. There's astounding fight sequences. It is super gory. Also, lots of people get shot and stabbed and keep going. There's definitely a little bit of that. They all have hit points.
Right, right.
So they can take a bunch of hits and then they just drop.
Don't... right. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
There's a big throwdown between the main character and one of his old pals that's just a extended two-man fight, which is impressive after you've done the thing where one of the characters has gone through and wiped out like a gang of like 20 people.
Yeah.
And then you see him go up against another guy who also has taken out a gang of like 20 people. And you're like, oh, these two are the mega fighters. They fight each other.
I can really relate to that.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. Anyway, this was really fantastic. I had recommended to me by some friends who saw it at Fantastic Fest.
Say the name again.
It is called The Night Comes for Us.
Did you feel that it's a standalone movie, or is this kind of possible sequels should they want to? Like any kind of action movie is potentially a sequel.
They could definitely do a sequel. I can see it. I don't think there was an intent, but I could definitely see them doing a
sequel. Sort of a John Wick style.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I really love this. I highly recommend it.
I'm definitely going to forget the title by tomorrow because it's not quite super catchy.
Right, yeah.
But I will try and catch that this week. It sounds cool.
All right. We want to talk about a podcast that all of us listen to some episodes of.
Yep. It has the word horror in it, but it's not...
It's more crimey.
It's more crime suspense slice of life, almost.
Yeah.
So the title of this podcast is The Horror of Dolores Roach.
Yep.
Which is not a super enticing podcast name, nope. But it's from the mega team that put together. It's from Gimlet, and
they did Sandra. They did Homecoming.
Yeah, it was podcasts that have been basically number one podcasts when they're out.
And they do fiction podcasts with like A-list cast,
well, right?
Like,
among
Homecoming
other...
is getting turned into an HBO series.
Amazon
is it Amazon?
Yep.
With Julia Roberts.
And as a show, it had, voice casting, was it Catherine Keener in it? And Oscar Isaac.
Yep.
Is it Isaac or Isaacs? I can never remember.
I think it's Isaacs. I don't
and
know.
And David Schwimmer.
Okay, I'm just glad that other people forgot, too.
Yep.
Anyway, so they grab A-list people. Now, interestingly, I don't think I knew anybody on this, but it's an amazing cast. Clearly... Yep. Their voice casting, their voice talents are stunning.
The main character, Dolores Roach, is voiced by Daphne Rubin Vega, who's been in Rent and Smash.
Okay, I could see that.
And Bobby Cannavale, who was in Homecoming, apparently. Or, no, he's in the TV version of Homecoming.
He's in the TV version of Homecoming.
Oh,
and
crazy.
He's been on Mr. Robot, he's been on Boardwalk Empire.
He's in the MN movies.
He's in the MN movies.
Is he like, is it Luis?
No, he's the cop, the new husband.
Okay, gotcha.
He's a great actor, and he's really good in this.
So, let's say what the premise is.
What is the premise?
A woman in her 30s, I'm guessing, because she's been in prison for 16 years.
At least her 30s, maybe a little older.
Yeah, it's her first day out of jail, and she's a little bit aimless, but she has one kind of goal to get to. So I feel like thematically this is a story that's a little bit about sort of race and gentrification
for sure,
and slum life in
because
a little bit.
Early on, she finds an empanada shop that is like the only thing that's still around her. She's talking about how her neighbors change. Everything's like a Chase Bank and a Starbucks.
Or Starbucks, yeah.
And this place is still there.
And she grew up in a bad neighborhood it clearly used to be a rough place.
Yeah.
But, there's all these interesting reminiscences. She'll talk about how it was, or her friend Luis will talk about how it was rough, but it was also, clean.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't trash around like there is
right.
now
yeah.
and stuff like that. But, yeah, she goes to... She also has a secret that she went to a place where she and her boyfriend used to live.
Yeah.
And essentially their secret hold-up stash of money that was thousands of dollars, their nest egg is gone.
Yep.
No surprise after 16 years.
Yeah. He's vanished.
But it does throw her for a loop and the mystery of kind of what happened to that guy and maybe what his intents were because in her flashbacks... He's, super caring. He actually was a halfway decent guy.
But we're only seeing the flashbacks from her point of view.
Right. And it's clear she may not be the best judge of things, but she's a super interesting character. Where things kind of get going is when she runs into the guy who runs the empanada shop, who used to know her back in the day.
Right.
And kind of clearly has a bit of a thing for her still.
Yeah.
He kind of takes her in.
Yeah.
And... is actually so kind of weirdly considerate of her that I immediately was suspicious
Me
of him.
Too.
But the way things have played out since, I'm less so. He seems more like he's a genuine guy, and I really like his character.
Yeah.
I will be sad if it turns out that
I think they're both
the
a little crazy, but I don't think either of them is...
They feel like kind of normal crazy people.
Yeah.
What's interesting, he actually has some interesting observations on the life that they live.
Yeah, sure.
Between them kind of getting high and trying to get her back on her feet. This is a pretty R-rated podcast, by the way.
Yeah.
Heavy language and, I'm going to say, drug use.
Yeah.
But it's not... It is presented in a hugely non-judgmental way.
Yeah.
And I really like that about it and respect that about it. Because I like just hearing these characters talk to each other. And they're pretty entertaining even when they're high.
Yeah.
Maybe especially when they're high. He's got some interesting perspectives on how they are trying to sort of bend some legal rules here and there, whether it's about paying rent and other stuff, based on the fact that they have been, taking so much shit in their lives.
Yeah.
And they, it's honestly, he makes a pretty good case at times.
How far are you into this?
I feel like I'm three or four episodes
into it. Because I'm three in, and the one complaint I have about this, which I think will ultimately be not really that important, is that it does take a while to get to it, just like Sandra did.
Well,
like
if you're talking about the big event that happens,
I'm just talking about the story.
Yeah.
I just feel like Gimlet's style, this is their third podcast, their third story podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Gimlet's style is to sort of really slowly let you in, which I think most story podcasts do not have the luxury of that. Gimlet has they have a budget.
Right, and I think because their moment-to-moment writing is so good, you kind of trust the audience to come along for the ride.
And I do.
Each episode does sort of end on something of a cliffhanger.
Well, the first episode, we can say what the end of the first episode is.
Sure.
Right? The first episode, she's talking about this. She's in this little basement apartment, and she's talking about the bed and then the room, and she says something like, and then there were a bunch of murders there or something like that. And clearly,
well, where the Luis's... father died.
Right, but then she's
and she's said, like, I didn't know that
wouldn't be far from the last death that would happen.
It definitely
here.
Sounds like there's going to be a lot of death in that room, and I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah,
and even episode three, I still don't quite. We're starting to get a little sense of it.
Right,
but they definitely are spinning out. They're like, hey, fall in love with the characters, well, and then we're going to tell you the story.
If you haven't seen it, there's something coming up.
Yeah,
I feel like the next episode that you're on is probably where something pretty dramatic happens.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not too far afield from like an Ed Brubaker criminal book.
Oh yeah.
It also like, well, you know, we talked about Homecoming before, which is largely conversations between a soldier dealing with PTSD mm-hmm. and his therapist for like several episodes until you find out the sort of the hook, if there's anything that's kind of not normal about it, is that they're doing some experimental drug testing on him that are making these soldiers literally kind of lose some of the memories that are dogging them. And there's the morality of that comes into far sharper focus of that as the series goes on.
Yeah.
This series is also looks, you know, a look at morality and gray morality and stuff like that. And I think that'll be a bigger part as it goes on.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that I sort of don't know where these are going for the most part.
I think this of all the three Gimlet podcasts, this gives you a sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't hurt that it's set in New York City. But they do an amazing job, like, I feel like I can taste those empanadas. Like, I want...
Oh, yeah.
They talk about what's in the different empanadas, and I'm like, oh, man, I want those empanadas.
Yeah.
And they talk about the neighborhood, which
it is, like,
out,
super...
Like,
it feels very real.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like everything feels real, and it has, like... I feel like they've kind of stepped a little bit, like, out of the sort of normal, the upper-middle-class white people things, which with... You could say probably both Sandra and...
Sandra was sort of Midwest, lower middle class
right.
kind of thing.
But I think the fact that she was kind of working for, like, essentially for Alexa, or, you know, one of those Siri type of things, it sort of felt very, a lot of NPR programming and, like, podcasts and stuff like that feels very white boy.
Yeah.
and this kind of broke away from that a little bit. And I think in a smart way, and a way that still feels pretty real.
Well, it's completely gripping, and they dropped all eight episodes just like they always do, so you can burn through the whole thing. And I started listening to it today. I'm through three episodes already.
Yeah. I think I'm like maybe a little more than halfway through there, so I'm like might be on episode five or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. Eight episodes, so I'm closing in on it.
Yeah, it's very compelling.
Do we know if it's a single season or if there's going to be a follow-up to this one?
They never seem to say, although they have not done a follow-up to any... did Homecoming have a second season?
It did.
Okay. So, but they haven't done a follow-up to Sandra, so I don't know.
Right. Anyway, really interesting. I feel like you give it that first episode and you'll have a sense of whether you're going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But if you liked Sandra or Homecoming, you should definitely check it out.
Yeah. Finally, you guys were going to talk about the new movie Halloween.
This is the strange history of Halloween, which with various movies ignoring the continuity of various other movies. I'd forgotten that they already have put out, like, at least twice since the original ones, or, like, at least once since the original ones, they've said, don't count these movies, but do count this
right.
movie.
It's kind of got a selective memory in a lot of ways.
And then Rob Zombie did his relaunch, which was its own separate continuity.
Yep.
Sure.
This new one is essentially meant to serve as a sequel to the original and to ignore everything else.
Exactly.
Nick, you want to, like, fill us in on what the plot is or kind of how it gets going?
Yeah, I mean, it basically just takes place a little bit after the...
what is it, 30? 40 years?
If
it was 1978, that's 40 years ago,
40
right?
years. It takes place 40 years after that night where Michael killed five people.
And terrorized, in particular, Laurie Strode, a.k.a. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Correct. And this sort of deals with some... two individuals trying to sort of make a podcast about Michael Myers and sort of delving into his history and
Well, they're ultimately they're somewhat tangential, but that does set things in motion.
Yeah,
it's largely about Laurie Strode and her family.
Yeah,
she's got a strained relationship, but it does. Yeah, it kicks off with these.
I just thought it was a very unnerving sequence of like.
I thought the opening was fantastic
with the kind of mental hospital and sort of how they introduced a new doctor who worked under Dr. Loomis.
Right.
Kind
of hilariously and slightly meta. Later on, Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis, when she meets him and sees he's kind of an eccentric-driven doctor, she's like, oh, so you're the new Loomis.
Yep.
Or the new Dr. Loomis.
Yep. Psychiatrists don't do well in these movies. I'm thinking the psychiatrists in the Terminator movies. They're not well respected in.
I hate to say that this continues that tradition, but this absolutely continues that tradition.
There's a twist with
he's
it.
He's interesting. It's not quite doesn't go quite where you would think it would. But yes.
But I will argue that Loomis has never been a great psychiatrist. He's really just a man on a mission wanting to kill a guy.
He was not the guy you would want treating you. He was very quick to say that Michael Myers was evil, should be destroyed, should be burned to the ground. Now that said, he made a great character.
Yes, he was a great character.
And if you were playing, it was almost like you were playing a Call of Cthulhu game, and you're like playing the psychotherapist or whatever, and you're like, okay, but at some point I'm going to have to put somebody down with a gun, right?
Right.
Loomis was ready to do that. He was a Call of Cthulhu character, I believe.
But yeah, so yes, this kind of, of course Michael Myers escapes, because they're transferring him to a max prison.
Yep.
Out of the psychiatric wing of somewhere. And of course something goes wrong.
I wanted to quick mention, in that opening scene, the approach to him, which they showed on the trailers notably, is really effective, where the guy to try, because he hasn't like talked to anybody in 40 years, and these guys even have the notion that they want to try and like pay Laurie Strode to hear her story. They were like, we want you to talk to him. We think you're the only person who might elicit a reaction from him. And she's like clearly like kind of gotten prepper afterwards. Yeah. Her life has fallen apart, but she's like trained herself to kill.
Well, it's also just the psychological damage that she got from that night. Like, her friends were killed,
right,
and then she never felt safe.
It sort of has defined her life, but meanwhile, her daughter, and who's a mom now, and that mom's daughter, her granddaughter, they're kind of trying to move on with their lives. Yeah. And kind of put grandma behind them.
Her daughter is played by Judy Greer?
From
a million different things. I mean, there is kind of a lot of similarities with the Halloween movie.
Right. It's essentially they're fairly simple stories. Like, once he's loose, there's a manhunt kind of thing going on. There's a question of, well, what is his motivation? What is he trying to do? Is he just trying to go after her again? Does he have something in mind with her family?
Oh, and the other character that comes back is the sheriff.
Right. It was not the same actor.
Not the same actor, but it's the same character.
Yeah, they said that the first cop who was like on the scene or whatever, maybe stopped Loomis from killing him way back when, played by the excellent character actor
from No Way Out.
He was in No Way Out and Mothman Prophecies and Armageddon.
Yeah.
I'm looking for it.
Why am I blanking on his name? But regardless, he gets to sort of chew the scene a little bit on that.
Yeah. When I mentioned the podcast people, the thing that I thought was really cool about that scene is they go up on the rooftop where Michael and...
Will Patton.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other inmates up there, and they're trying to have Michael look at the mask, and he like won't even turn around.
Yeah.
But all the other inmates start like chattering or like screaming or like scratching at themselves as if something totemic is happening.
Yeah.
And even though I don't really like the idea of quite going mystic or anything with Michael Myers, it was a very effective scene for kind of, he's, if nothing else, there have been 40 years of film history, and he has become totemic. So, and that scene kind of almost acknowledged the weight of that power. Now that said, I know you like the movie quite a bit. I was a little more met on it just because it does kind of, even though there's some strong, decent characterization and writing on it, it is still a sort of slasher movie.
It is a slasher movie. I felt like the final confrontation between those two characters, I felt like earned it, and I think
the ending of it, it actually, I think, ends very strong, and like almost kind of turned around how I was feeling about it. Not quite, but it actually, in a rare case, I felt like it was like the last 15 minutes or so were some of the strongest scenes in it.
Yeah, and I really like Jamie Lee Curtis's character.
Yep.
And how she portrayed that, and the relationship with her daughter and then her granddaughter felt very real. And, it was interesting.
There's a fair amount with the granddaughter who she's in high school and she's basically in the same spot Laurie was.
I was gonna say, she's the new Laurie Strode.
She's
got friends.
Mostly a good girl, not quite as like kind of prudish as they made Laurie out to be. But she's dealing with some sort of normal high school stuff, and some of her friends get pulled into this circle of violence as well.
Yeah, I will say, my one criticism, and I knew going in that was going to be the case. This is definitely more bloody than the Carpenter's Halloween was, because Carpenter had no blood.
Right,
it was almost like 30 years ago.
40
years ago.
But it was an act of choice.
There was some pretty serious violence in it, in the sense of like you did see a person pinned to a door with a butcher knife and stuff like that. Certainly, the Friday the 13th movies that kind of emulated this afterwards in a cheaper sort of way, they upped the gore over time.
And
that kind of became normal. Although this has one or two scenes in it that are pretty gory, it's actually not overall like a super gory movie, I think. There's one scene. I know what scene you're talking about.
But there's throughout. I mean, once Michael Myers has escaped, he's literally like a lawnmower just going through people.
Yeah.
Like, just wherever he goes.
I feel like I've seen much bloodier movies, though. Much bloodier.
Well, yeah, but I'm just talking in tradition.
Because sometimes he'll just break somebody's neck.
Yeah.
Now that person might be a child, and that was pretty messed up. I didn't think it was like too gory.
No, I mean it definitely didn't hit some of the previous Halloween gore factor.
Like it didn't seem too trashy or anything to me. One guy made some pretty bad fate though. Let's see. There's something else I was going to mention. Oh, yeah. This is a personal... I'm going to have to call out one thing personally. There's a doofus in it named Dave. And the movie has a lot of his friends saying, like, "Ah, geez, Dave, you're such a dumbass. Dave, you know, what the hell is wrong with you?" My friends that I saw this with were very amused by this, but I was not.
Mm-hmm.
I felt called out.
So what you're saying is you're not amused by the fact that you're going to be getting those sound clips for the next 20 years.
Actually, I could work with it. It was pretty funny.
Speaking of sound, I also really enjoyed Carpenter's new soundtrack.
Kind of, reorchestrated sort of a lot of the audio cues and stuff from the original, and the musical stings and even the famous theme are all there, but slightly tweaked, and they did a good job with
them. Yeah, I don't feel like Carpenter's definitely in his heyday anymore.
No, but it was...
But it's solid
It's
stuff.
Very good.
I definitely would... Say see it, especially if you have some fit.
If you feel like you might want to see it, then you should probably see it.
It's an interesting recommendation.
Yeah. If you're like, I hate horror movies, or maybe even if you were like me and you're like, I love the original Halloween, but like that was kind of all I ever wanted to see of Michael Myers, probably don't see it.
Okay.
But I feel like it has a decent bit to offer. And it's generally worth seeing it if you like that kind of stuff.
All right. That wraps up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.